But if y'all can't hear me, I'll speak up. Maybe I'll talk louder than you do. So, I'm here to talk about Beehive, which is one of the new features in previous V10. And this is me. All right. So what is a bit about what we'll talk about tonight. First, I'll talk about what is Beehive. You know, it's a hypervisor, but a little more detail on what kind of hypervisor it is. Some of the requirements it places on both the guest and the host, and what guests are known to work currently with Beehive. I'll also talk about some of the mechanics of just running a guest. What the steps you have to do, some of the scripts and wrappers that make it a little bit easier to do. And then I'll talk a little bit about how to set up networking on the host and the guest, a couple different setups that I've used that I found useful. And after that, we'll attempt the demo, which I think will actually work based on my trials over this afternoon. And then we'll open up for questions. So Beehive, as I mentioned, is a hypervisor, but it's a kind of different kind of hypervisor. I must confess, being a developer, I actually don't play with things until I have to work on them. So I hadn't really had a lot of experience with hypervisors, and so I started playing with Beehive on my own for fun. And the folks who work at Beehive were taking a different approach to, as opposed to traditional hypervisors that have been around a much longer time, like Xen and so forth. In particular, they wanted to write a hypervisor that worked on modern hardware and a kind of small, lean hypervisor that has to depend on, has to deal with older systems. So, for example, they require hardware support in the processor for handling some kind of hardware accelerated virtualization mode. They require the processor to handle, for example, nested page tables, because doing all that software is a complete pain in the tush. And you don't have to now. You can require hardware to do that, and when you do that, you can write something that's a lot simpler, at least to get started. And so there's various shortcuts they took to try to get a hypervisor. In particular, the original office were trying to build a hypervisor for a specific product from the company they worked at. And so they were targeting more recent hardware, and they made several trade-offs to get something running up quickly as possible. And there were different reasons why they made some of the trade-offs. Some of them, as I mentioned, with nested page tables, was a matter of preserving their sanity, because you don't want to have to do all that in software. You have to emulate all sorts of crazy crap if you want to try to emulate a software interview. Whereas if the hardware can do it, that makes it much simpler. But they also made some other trade-offs. They, for example, they additionally required the guests to access the local APIC, which is the part of the processor that handles interrupt management, using a new feature that actually isn't in shipping hardware until I think this year, using MSRs instead of memory access. Because that's simpler to emulate. You get a much nicer fault inside your hypervisor for an MSR access than you do for memory access. For memory access, you actually have to decode the instruction and figure out what address it's actually accessing and what register it wants to read or write it into. And with MSR access, you don't have to do that. It's a lot simpler. So they made the choice initially to require MSR access for the APIC. Similarly, for PCI interrupts, they originally only allowed MSI interrupts because they are a lot simpler to emulate than legacy interrupts that PCI normally has. You don't have to deal with emulating the PIC and everything. So, that, of course, the standard that they chose, which is VertIO for their device drivers, for their virtual interfaces, didn't actually support MSI, so they kind of had to hack drivers and existing OSs to kind of add this non-standard way of doing interrupts to VertIO interfaces. So they had different reasons for their choices. Some of them were due to this expediency, some of them were due to the fact that, you know, EPT was a lot better. So going forward, many of those choices that were made because of expediency are going to be, those things are going to be filled in. For example, in previous V10, Beehive already supports fully legacy PCI interrupts, well, mostly fully. My laptop has more of it. But we're not going to require MSI anymore. It already allowed the APIC to run nodes using normal memory access and not requiring the MSR trick, for example. So some of those things are being backfilled, but there are other changes such as requiring hardware acceleration in the CPU or requiring hardware acceleration for the MMU. That's just a fundamental part of the system they designed. They're not trying to be a completely software solution like Xen. They're saying we can take advantage of modern hardware and kind of have a higher baseline for what we require on the host. One of the other big gaps that greatly restricts the guests that can be run is Beehive provides no kind of system firmware. So it provides nothing like BIOS, IS writers are the bane of my existence working on OS4. It's just some of the worst stuff you can work with. And so having to write one from the back is also equally painful. It's a really horrid interface, and one that has kind of slowly evolved over time and is more warped than anything else at this point. So they not really have a keen appetite for writing one from scratch, but there is work in progress to kind of move toward there. Similarly, there's another option for firmware is EFI, and in fact, that's probably the direction that Beehive will move to in the future. There's a guy who's working on a EFI layer for Beehive, and one of the things you can get with an EFI layer is you can actually get a compatibility interface referred to as CSIM that gives you a BIOS interface that is backed by EFI services. So going forward, that's the direction Beehive will move. It's going to take a while to get there, and so currently the system doesn't have a system firmware and requires a different way to load, kind of bootstrap your operating system, which is quite different from most other traditional hypervisors you might have worked with. One other kind of current restriction of the way it's designed, it doesn't have a lot of virtual devices that it emulates. Many hypervisors, for example, emulate like an Intel E1000 NIC and like a normal, you know, old IDE PAD or SATA storage controller. Initially, Beehive only supported VirtIO devices for block and network. It has recently gained HCI support for storage, but currently for network, the only supported device is VirtIO. They are, I know some folks are working on the E1000 type, emulated E1000 interface, so eventually, when that is backfilled, it'll be more possible to run off operating systems that don't have to have VirtIO drivers, for example. But that's part of this philosophy of making something that is quick, that we can get up and running, doesn't have a lot of dependencies and lots of things that are very hard to emulate, but things instead that are very friendly to implementing a hypervisor. So this kind of ties in with what requirements comes out of this design on both the host and on the guest. So on the host, your CPU has to have support, and it has to not just be basic support, it has to support nested page tables. In addition, if you want to use an operating system that wants to use multiple cores, or if you want to run in 32-bit mode, you need at least, I think it's Westmere and the Halo, where they added a capability on Intel processors called unrestricted guest mode, which allows a guest to run without having paging enabled. Because usually when you're starting up application processors for SMT, they need to start up in real mode and kind of kick themselves along the way to actually get to where the OS wants them to be. And again, Beehive doesn't want to have to try to have a bunch of complex stuff to try to emulate the lack of an independent software, and so they just require you to have them, and if you don't, then you can run a single CPU 64-bit guest, and that's it. But all currently shipping Intel products now have, that do virtualization, do have unrestricted guests as a capability. There is the ability, currently the only thing checked into head is the ability to use Intel processors. There is a projects branch in SVM that does have support for using AMD processors instead. And Nicely graciously hosts a couple of some snapshots that are built against that branch that you can download to use to run on the host with AMD processors to run Beehive Guest. I don't know exactly how stable that is. I imagine it's not completely perfect or they would have merged it to head already. But it is available, and certainly the Beehive design, from the beginning, they have abstraction levels in place to allow for both AMD and Intel and other x86 processor backends. There's also some thought to allowing hardware-accelerated virtualization on other platforms that support it, although much of the Beehive code is pretty x86-specific, especially the user line component that actually emulates virtual devices. But it's not completely... It is part of the design ultimately to allow other platforms that have hardware acceleration for virtualization to also be integrated into Beehive and to support a monitor and a people on hypervisor. In terms of the guest, as I mentioned, currently you really need VirtIO drivers. You can use HCI interface for disks, but it works best with VirtIO drivers. And until recently, in head, you needed to have a VirtIO driver that was able to use MSI. Or MSIX, both of which work. And MSIX is actually standard now in VirtIO, but I think when they started it was not. So you may have to have hacked up VirtIO drivers depending on what version you're running on the host. You also, your guest needs to be able to work with a serial console. There is no VGA emulation. Again, that's hard. It is planned eventually, but it is not there yet. So the only console available to guest is a serial device. So your guest has to be happy doing that, which means it's going to be a little longer until Windows runs in this, for example, because if you had firmware. And finally, the lack of a BIOS of firmware means that you have to use a completely different strategy for how you bootstrap your operating system. instead of starting up a bare bones machine that then talks to emulated devices, even and loads things within the guest, like loads your operating system and bootstraps and loads your kernel. Instead, you run a userland program on the host itself, which is a native PBC application that locates your kernel and your modules and various things, loads them into the guest address space, kind of arranges things correctly for the entry point, and then when your guest begins execution, it starts at the entry point of your kernel directly. So you kind of skip the entire bootstrap phase and start the guest directly in your OS's kernel. And so that's kind of one of the reasons for restricting what guests are available is you have to have a suitable loader that runs the user one that can run your guest operating system. I guess I should mention, so that last point, there are two different loaders available. There's one in the base system called Beehive Load, which is specifically to load FreeBSD guests. And head, it supports 64-bit and 32-bit x86 guests. And Tendo release only supported 64-bit, but that should be merged in time for Tendo 1 to support both 32 and 64-bit. You can tell just over this. And I had at least run 8x and later guests, both 64 and 32-bit. Both of those releases include, or later releases in the 8x branches, include BERT IO drivers, which is kind of the basic requirement that FreeBSD really needs to work correctly in Beehive. There's another loader, a userLAN loader for loading kernels available in ports, which is a port of Grub to run with Beehive. And using that loader, you can load most of the other guests that are supported currently by Beehive. Another has booted 64-bit OpenBSD. The one caveat that I'm aware of is that the kernel that is on the install CD doesn't, I believe, it probably doesn't have the BERT IO driver, so it doesn't boot, but if you boot one of the other kernels, OpenBSD will work just fine. NetBSD has also been booted. I know they used it recently in custom patches. It does a couple of things that other guest operating systems doesn't do, that they are still working on emulating correctly. It uses a weird instructions right to a serial console, for example, that's not currently emulated. So it needs a few patches that are not yet in the tree but are being worked on, but it is known to work with those patches in place. The various folks have booted different distributions of Linux. To date, I believe folks have only booted 64-bit Linux in Beehive, although in theory a 32-bit guest might work if you really needed that for some reason. And the Beehive developers have also been able to boot a version of the Lumos. Lumos apparently really wants to have a BIOS for at least some of its services. So currently they have a bit of a partial BIOS emulation layer in place that gives a fair bit on the Lumos needs. So out of the box, Lumos doesn't currently work, but it can be made to work with a kind of shim BIOS. So what makes up Beehive? What are the things inside of Beehive that kind of build a hypervisor? You have several different components that work together to actually provide an emulated guest environment for a guest to run it. First, you have a driver inside the kernel. It's called VMM, which stands for Virtual Machine Monitor. This actually handles switching the processor into VMX mode and running the actual guest in CPU time. It also handles many of the faults and exceptions that you can get inside a guest when a guest runs a privileged instruction that's not already fully emulated in hardware, or if it tries memory access to a virtualized device, and that causes a trap, and that traps into the kernel module. Many of the traps it actually handles internally. There are certain devices, such as the interrupt controllers, some of the timers that are fully handled, fully emulated entirely in the kernel module, to avoid this kind of latency of going out to use the LAN and back. For some of the other devices, such as the PCI printings or BERT IO or HCI, they're actually done in a userLAN process. It's called Beehive. And Beehive is the process that actually runs on the host and donates its CPU time to the guest to run. It has a thread per virtual CPU inside the guest. It also has a couple of worker threads to handle asynchronous events for example, the BERT IO storage devices. And it has another worker thread just to kind of handle asynchronous event notification internally for the host to interact with the guest itself. In addition to that, you have, as I mentioned before, you have an OS loader of some sort. You either have the one that's used for FreeBSD Beehive Load, or you have the one for ports, the port of Grub. And then finally, there's a little utility called Beehive Kettle, or Control, which is used for different administrative tasks you can perform on a guest. Mostly, the most useful thing I've found it can do is that you can dump a bunch of stats, which if you're working on the hypervisor, you can find out whatever the current register state or counter to different events and things used for debugging. You can also, beyond that, we've got too many more useful things to do. You can do some limited event injection. For example, you can, this can be useful for us development. You can inject NMIs to arbitrary virtual CPUs inside the guest, which can be useful to break into the debugger, for example, if the guest appears to be hung. And some other kind of low-level control things like that. I don't want to get a piece of these things. So, because the Hive is a little different, especially because it has this user space loader, it kind of has a different life cycle than you might be used to from other hypervisors. With many other hypervisors, you start one program, the program starts up, it manages the entire life cycle of handles, reboots and stuff all internally. And Beehive doesn't quite work that way. It kind of has these series of steps it has to go through, and you kind of have to manage the loop yourself. So first of all, in a typical guest, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to make sure that any pre-existing state for a given virtual machine is blown away so you have a clean slate to start with. So this is the one command from Beehive Kibble you might actually use, which is just dash destroy that destroys whatever state is currently associated with a given VM so no one can get created. The next step is to load, is to actually invoke the userland loader, whether it's Beehive load or grub to Beehive, which takes care of preloading your kernel, setting some of your initial state up for your execution environment. And finally, you run the Beehive process, and you give it like 87 command line arguments that I can't remember off the top of my head to configure all the different devices you want. You get to lay out the PCI topology in extreme detail, perhaps too much extreme detail, and tell all the devices you want to be emulated. You can specify things such as if you actually want to be able to attach a GDB instance to the guest through a special virtualized device that Beehive supports, and so on, a couple other things. And then if you want to simulate a real machine where you can reboot the box and it comes back up and it kind of has a normal life cycle machine, you have to stick it in a loop, some sort of while loop or something along those lines to do that. Well, this is kind of tedious to do. If you want to do this by hand, you can cross up arrows. Say again?
Hash bang bin sh.
Well, exactly. So one of the things that shifts from the base system is a wrapper script that is useful for running previous guests. It's in user share examples, Beehive, vmrun.sh, and it handles the logic of this loop for you. It also has some other handy wrapper features. For instance, if your guest disk device doesn't have a boot sector currently, in which case it will actually pick up and install ISO that you pointed at and use that as the boot device instead for your initial install of the OS into your guest, and then once that's present, it will boot the guest directly. It manages the reboot loop, so that it will keep invoking these things in a loop so that the user experience on a host, or if you've associated with the machine and you're using it for development and rebooting it, it will look like a real machine. It will reboot, for example. It also has some support for one of the things that was added recently to Beehive is it actually supports ACPI soft off, and that it, which all it means is in terms of the Beehive control process returns a different value from exit, and the VM run loop is smart enough to see that and break out of the loop so that if you invoke power off or a shutdown minus P from a guest, it'll actually exit the loop cleanly. The machine will actually act as if it's off, as opposed to continuously rebooting, which can be annoying. It does assume a very simple machine layout, VM run. It wants to build a guest that has a single disk, a single network interface, and nothing else more complicated than that. However, if you want to have more complicated machines you want to build, it's a pretty good template that you can extend if you want to create different machine configurations. It's a good place to start because it already gives you the basis of this run loop and wrappers for several of the different arguments you could pass to Beehive. In particular, it helps you build the actual Beehive command line, which can be pretty long. When we do the demo, I'll switch to another window and show you. Well, I can't show you the command line because Beehive crashes it. I'll show you the script. So one question many folks have, if you're a kernel debugger, it's great to run it interactively in a window, but if you actually want to use it for a product, you obviously don't want to have an extern sitting open somewhere that has to run the console, and if it goes away, then the Beehive process gets killed. So you want to probably be able to have options to run this in more of a detached mode. The simplest way, because the serial console of the guest is linked to standard I/O, is just to run it in like Spring or Tmux or something like that. There are other options available if you would rather not do that. One, the other primary option available is you can use the null modem device wrapper in FreeBSD. and you can attach the serial console of a guest to one end of the modem, and then you can optionally, when you decide, attach to the other end. And whatever you want to attach, you can or not. One area that this is kind of useful is if you want to run, if you want to use a kernel debugger and you don't want to deal with the kind of virtualized interface for debugging that Beehive provides, you can attach a serial port to one end of a null modem, and then you can fire up GDB on the host, and you can target remote pointed at the other end of the null modem device. And you can on the host run a kernel version of GDB and cross debug your guest run, your OS running your guest is kind of nice. And the final one thing I mentioned previously, which is you do have some administrative, you can do some control from the host just with signals. SigTerm is actually wired, I should have mentioned this previously. The softball emulation in Beehive takes two components. One is that if you do shut down on SPU, you power off, it will actually invoke an ACGI method, which will tell the guest to kind of gracefully exit and exit out of the loop. But the other feature it has is we wired up SigTerm as kind of a virtual power button, so that if you hit SigTerm, the guest acts as if it's seen the power button push, and so it will gracefully shut down on its own. So if you run an ACGI aware OS and you do SigTerm, the guest should kind of gracefully do a normal clean shutdown and then exit the loop cleanly. And if that doesn't work, SigChill is still the equivalent of holding the power button for 4 seconds if it completely hangs. And if it doesn't support ACGI, then SigTerm is instant death, just like SigChill. So the next thing, one of the things that a guest is nice, but you want a guest to probably do something, and probably do something talking to somebody else. Now, you might want different places your guest to talk to. You might not want your guest to get outside of the host. You might want your guest to talk to the outside world. And so there's a couple of different setups for how you manage to do that. I'm going to go over two setups that I've used. The one that gets most documented on the net is the first one, which is simply bridging the network interface of one of your guests through a LAN that your host is already attached to, in which case your guest shows up as another device on that physical LAN. And the second one I'm going to talk about is one that I kind of find a little more useful, especially on my laptop, which is a way to create a virtual internal LAN on your laptop itself, have all the guests be a part of that, and use NAT if you need to expose them to the rest of the world. But your guests are not public, you know, whoever network your laptop is connected to. It's a little more familiar. If you run VMware Fusion on your Mac, and you probably create a guest and you told them to do a NAT setup, it gives you the kind of same effect. In both cases, I use a bridge device to actually handle shuffling the traffic between the guest and the host or the guest and the outside world. And on the host, all guest interfaces are managed by creating a TAP interface on the host, and then that gets exported as a virtual network device inside the guest. So in the simple approach, that's to simply bridge your guests to the outside world directly. So in this case, we have a host who has a Intel E1000 or EM0 device that it uses to talk to the outside world. We set up a bridge. We add the interface to the outside world, EM0, to the bridge, and we add the TAP interface on the host to the bridge. When the guest boots up, if it's a FreeBSD guest, they'll use the VTNet driver, which will kind of attach to the Bird IO into the interface inside the guest. And then the host that will show up the traffic from TAP 0, and the traffic will flow up into the bridge and back out the interface to EM0. And for other machines on the same network as EM0, they'll see this new device show up. So how do you set that up?
So the MAC address will appear to be the MAC address of EM0?
No, it's just its own MAC address. I believe TAP auto-assigns one. In fact, I think we even have George applied for a OUI for FreeBSD, and it's a dedicated subrange that OUI for Beehive guests.
Ah, excellent.
So to do it by hand, you can create a bridge that can fit, you add the two interfaces and dismembers, you bring the bridge up, and those won't pass traffic. And once you've done that, you start up a guest, and anything that the guest does will pull out the bridge onto the host-attached LAN. If you run into the DHCP client, it will find some DHCP server out on the host-attached LAN. If you want to set this up more permanently inside rc.conf, the first thing you need to do is you need to make sure the interfaces get created on boot. And cloned interfaces is a way to do that. You want the bridge interface to be configured up so it'll actually pass traffic. And then finally, there's a way to, on rc.conf, cover bridge is a way to configure what interfaces are added to a bridge on boot. In this case, cover bridge interfaces is a list of bridges I have in the system. For each bridge you have in the system, you have another variable, cover bridge underscore through whatever the name of the bridge is, and that variable holds the list of the devices that actually belong to the bridge. One nice kind of nifty feature that I'll show in the next example, you can actually use shell blobs. So one example that can be useful if you have multiple guest interfaces is you can use tap star, and then all the tap interfaces you create in your host will get, if they're created during boot, will get added to the bridge without having to list them all out by hand. So the other setup is a little different, and I couldn't quite fit everything I wanted to say on the slide, so I'll go through some. So in this case, we have three different guests that are running as independent machines. So even it looks like one guest, you can imagine there's full data. Three completely different guests. Each one is attached to a host with different tap interfaces. The different tap interfaces are all joined to the bridge. In this case, I don't have a host interface attached to the bridge as a member. Instead, if you assign an address from the top of the bridge, then the bridge actually becomes a real interface inside the host. And so it can pass traffic directly to the host. And in that case, your guest can directly access the host internally by going directly to this IP. So for example, if you go to /24 for this, you would give this guy the .1, which is the default router. And then if they want to get to the outside world, they simply route to the host as if there was a router on a normal network. So how do you set this up? I don't want to show you all the isconfig and whatever commands because it just takes a few blocks. So this is some lines you can put in rc.conf to provide this type of setup. As before, you need all the interfaces you want. In this case, we want three tap interfaces. We want a bridge device. You need to actually assign an address to the bridge. In this case, we're giving it the .1 for a /24 that I'm using. And then we want to add all the tap devices to the bridge using the same AutoBridge stuff as before. And if you want to be able to route to the outside world from here, then you'll need to turn on route. You'll need to block your box with gateway, so we'll do routing. Now, some further things you can do with this setup. If you want to do NAT, to hide so that your host, your best NAT to get to the outside world, it's kind of like you would set up NAT on any other dual home router box you might have, except that instead of your internal interface being like EM1 or FXT1 or whatever, it's bridge zero. So whatever normal rules you would apply to set up NAT from an inside interface to an outside interface, just treat bridge zero as an inside interface. And you can probably run NAT on your external interface, whether it's EM0 or Wavelength0 or something like that. And another very useful tool, which I didn't want to quite get into because it requires a lot of talk about, I use something called DNS mask from ports to manage the address allocation and DNS and DHCP on the internal network itself. It's really handy, actually. It will hand out, it will run at the DHCP server. You can run it directly on the bridge interface itself. It will hand out leases to guests. It runs a DNS server with its own internal aliases for the guest as well, meaning specifically that if your guest sends out a DHCP client request with an embedded client name or host name, it'll create a local DNS entry that maps that host name to whatever IP it assigns to the guest. And in practice, what this means is that all the guests, if you name your guest VM0 and VM1, they can connect to each other, SSH and whatnot, using VM0 and VM1 as a host name. If you put a static entry in empty host that maps to the .1 interface assigned to the bridge device, then you can have a host name that maps to the host, and all the different machines can SSH to each other. If you configure the host to use the DNS mask server as its DNS server, then from outside the host, we can SSH into whatever connections you wish into the guest directly as well. And it's pretty seamless. You don't have to deal with actually managing the DNS IP assignments or anything. DNS mask just manages it whenever it's something HTTP that adds the dynamic entry internally, and you don't have to do anything with it. It's pretty hands-off. So that's useful. So the next step is I'm going to show it off. On a previous C-laptop before. The first trick is we're going to resume the previous C-laptop, which might actually work.
Isn't that the most important part of the panel?
Oh, well,
there it goes.
Hey.
Amazingly enough, XLR&R actually works. I'm shocked. X can actually handle hot plugging a device. It blew my mind with the fortunate. I have low expectations for X, obviously. Let's make this readable. So I'm going to make, I tend to make a subdirectory for my desk. I will do that. Can y'all see in the back?
Of course.
Sort of.
Sort of. Unfortunately, so I think this is the bit extra wants to be. I know, it's already on the
huge. Yeah, that's huge. For sure, the value is huge.
Well, I knew the writing condition to pass the extra might be made with a bigger one. But
minus FN and then whatever font you want.
Yeah, that's the hard part of the string.
Just do 10 by 20, John.
Alright.
Yeah, just turn that font 10 by 20. Now make that one.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Let me kill the lights, that helps.
All you have to do is shrink the size of the window so it's all on the screen.
Yeah, if you want to put that open.
All right.
All right, how are we doing?
Better.
All right, so I'll start from the beginning. We'll make a little directory. Beehive only currently operates on raw disk images, but again, this is part of their theory that if you have a system that has a ZFS file system or some other Martin's file system that handles deduplication and stuff for you, that they can rely on the file system and then have the disk in the host itself or in the hypervisor itself. I'm going to use the wrapper script because I don't want to type in all the crazy stuff.
I think you lost focus.
I've done it this way. That's cheat sheet. In this case, we're going to have to use tap 0 as my interface. My laptop already has a couple of tap interfaces configured. Now, which disk image to use? This one, I'm going to tell you want a 32-bit or a 64-bit test?
64.
Okay. So we'll install sudo cmd64. Now I'll call this unimaginative. Don't want. So this is a program called VisuGoo, and normally wants 80 by 25 display, so it's unhappy. But this is actually something. This is Beehive Load, which is a port of bootloader from FreeBSD to run in UDOAN. So it actually has much of the code that's normally compiled in the bootloader compiled at this special shared object called UserGroup.sl, and the Beehive Load was kind of front into it that uses operations in the host to provide the kind of services that would normally be provided by a BIOS or a firmware for the bootloader. So in this case, it's not obvious. Well, let's do it.
Enter
full path. Yeah. I think I confused it into booting single user mode. It's looking like a demo and not look wrong.
Just kidding. Let's see what happens.
There we are.
And that will be a normal install, which you can clear. It's really cheaper than handily, but 925. So we'll give it a first name. And we'll just go with it a problem.
Can you make
the font
smaller?
Yes, we can make the font smaller.
Yeah,
that's too small. Anyway, don't install 2GSD before. This is kind of important for anyway. I'm going to use the 8GB disk because the other one is the ISO, it's not writable. I'm going to check all the defaults. Yada, yada, yada. Yeah, just keep getting it during until it's done.
It's like
Windows.
Yeah. Climb on a wall.
Well, it's all right installed. Right into the local disk. Okay. So let it finish installing. And in my case, I'm using on my laptop, I'm using the setup that, oh, I guess I can show you the command line. Let's see if I remember the right. Well, I can't show you the actual command line. Unfortunately, Beehive decides to replace the command line with the description of what it, of the hostname, and so you can actually see the command line arguments passed, and they're quite long. If you look at the wrapper script itself,
you need to parse that.
I think so. What's the command line? I think you're questioned that. I think I've tried that before. But if you look at the actual script itself at the bottom when it invokes Beehive directly, you see it does some work with some, all these different options are passed. And this is all the traffic that's passed to Beehive, which is why I recommend using a wrapper script instead of joining it yourself. In this case, it's actually enumerating a specific PCI device that it wants to have, including the single network interface, a single block device. You need an LPC device for the x86, you don't have half your system without legacy ESA, so you can go with legacy. It configures what 0.1 will talk to, which is by default is standard IO, and passes the name of the VM. It also configures the default settings from its RAM, which is sort of assigned to the guest, and it's used for the guest, and so forth. But it's Karen, you have to pass a lot of crap to it. I think, yes. The future plans are eventually, I believe, to move to a model where Beehive is configured via a config file rather than passing 87 command line options, in which case this will process will get a little bit nicer, especially once if firmware along the lines of EFI or FI simulation is provided and you have a single process manage entire lifestyle, not quite need this packaging.
John, do you know what the base memory size would be for this? And
how small you make it before it stops being functional? Well, how small you make FreeDSD
before it stops being functional? How much RAM you start a VM up with? What's the base?
The same as on VMware or any other virtual memory, any other virtualized system.
Oh, it's
half-actual.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Just thinking.
There you go.
No, we don't want that. Keep going. Just going, it doesn't matter.
Should have just picked Antarctica.
It's fine. Well,
I've always wanted to install
Antarctica. Now, one important thing to do. And I think
see
the show.
It's
not helpful, but I'm not
going to consider it. You can try to get the music, John.
I don't know. It may be configured already for a 40 column width.
No, we just saw him do it. So large.
Oh. Control that off. Move.
The anchor line, please. One, two.
Fly and exit, is that what you're looking for?
Well, I want to make sure I get back to Michelle. So one of the caveats is kernel FreeDSD doesn't quite turn on the serial console if you install over serial console, and you really want to do that.
Oh, you're in the
configuration.
Yeah, but won't it see that you don't have a video card and automatically switch over to serial?
Not yet.
So you've got to actually pass the minus P?
Yep. All right, thank you, Mr. Well, one of the two important steps, in this case, because I'm using a very simple guest, that is not on the network, I have the wireless turned off and everything, and I didn't bother creating another either.
So you got a root lighting, yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the right line.
Try to fix it, put it back on.
Clearly, you need more than anybody, whatever this is.
10 by 20.
So, I'm making this highly insecure.
You're not sweet.
Oh, I got it. Follow me.
Mount minus UW. Dude, just mount minus UW slash.
That's not an FFCAT.
Oh.
The problem is I'm in the recall system, and I need to mount the disk that I formatted earlier. I can type the volume better. I'm going to do a couple of things. First of all, I'm going to find a serial console and turn it on. VMware and VMware will do the thing where it will notice that now my disk image doesn't need to install anymore, so it won't actually invoke the install CD, and we'll come back running the guest. The guest will come up. And you can see I'm running the VMS mask, it flew by, and actually got a release. I forgot to disable SIM now, which will send the pain forever. And so there's my VM.
Yay!
And over here on the host, you can see that I can actually see it, but, this normally works just fine. So,
there you go.
The DNS server actually put a DNS mask, put an entry in. So I can be in here, I can ping the host, which is my dot one, because I have a line in, I'll show the line in FC host. And DNS mask automatically creates entries for it creates DNS entries to export to all its clients for anyone you have an XE host. So with one line XE host to handle the host mapping, all the guests can see the host is fine. And if I was not talking and had a wireless turned on, this could actually also get to the outside world through that over my life. So
excellent.
And we could log in because you're insecure.
Say again?
And we could log in and change it because you're insecure.
Log in. That's why the wireless is on. I'm not crazy. So in this case, if I ask it to actually power off, it's going to be the normal HTTP IP. I'm back in the guest. And I just reboot, and it acts like a machine. Right? If I rebooted, it would act like an old machine. That's the demo part. Magic of XLR.
So, John, you made mention, let me say that.
Sure.
So, you made mention before that this plays nicely with things like ZFS?
Well, so one of the author's points is that rather than having the hypervisor try to be really smart, it's really smart in terms of trying to do fancy things to manage breaking your backing disk image into a bunch of separate files and trying to debug among the different backing things. And you see the flat file and they assume that you will have a modern file system that will handle that stuff for you on the host side. So you don't have to try to put that intelligence into the hypervisor itself. They can rely on the host file system to do that.
It is that the Beehive is the minimal hypervisor. Right, so taking advantage of all the work that's been done in the last 10 or 15 years, they don't have to do all the crazy stuff that like the first VMware did, or ESX, or Xen, or any of those things.
Who's primarily responsible for the project? Like who's backing it and writing most of the code? And is that yourself or somebody else out there?
So there's initially Beehive started, as a project at NetApp, because they wish to use this for a shipping product, which is part of why it has the kind of minimal requirements it had. And the two developers who work on this at NetApp have since left NetApp and now have their own company where they have multiple clients, including NetApp, who are using this for a different base. And so they are the primary developers. They've also, I know they have a couple of folks, I don't know if they're full-time, I think at least one full-time. And maybe some folks and other folks that they are consulting with to work on it. And then I also hack on it in my free time. But most of the work is being done by the two gentlemen, Peter and Neil, the folks from NetApp, who have done most of the work and wrote all the initial work for it.
They're not at NetApp anymore.
Hmm?
But they're not at NetApp anymore.
That's the point.
Well, that's, yes. They have a company that does this.
Could you, I mean, this, you might not know the answer to this, but I'm guessing this is for NetApp's vFiler. Do you know if you can run, like, a vFiler on a previous host?
I think their point is to allow better failover within a head itself.
Well,
compared to some other solutions, believe me, they're not so dreamy.
I can't imagine the beach.
I believe the idea is that just as you have failover and hardware for certain components, that you can actually have, instead of having a hot sphere between two physically running CPUs, you can actually have hot failover between two guests. And have a simple previous DSD host running this.
And then it also to do the upgrade thing directly.
It might be for that.
Rapid upgrades and
swap over.
Interesting.
But I don't know exactly how this. I mean, next you'd have to ask NetApp how they use it.
Give me bad ideas.
I don't think their goal is to let you run some other app on the NetApp. Well, like, actually, a lot of stores that don't want you to do that now, but anyway.
Yes.
So, in the case of FreeBSD guests, if I'm running FreeBSD guests using Beehive, what advantage does this give me over running jails? It would seem Beehive is a little more resource intensive than running jails.
So there's a couple of reasons that I find it useful. I mean, that's true of in virtualization in general. It does allow you to run things other than FreeBSD as guests. It also allows you to have
Why would anybody want to run anything for FreeBSD?
There are weird people in the world.
Yeah,
they're not here, but there are weird people in the world.
There's one other operating system. I've never heard of it,
but Redmond. So you might want to do something that's not FreeBSD, or you might want to have a better bubble for different versions of FreeBSD. One thing I've used it for that's very useful is for development, it's kind of nice because you can actually run, especially if you're doing kernel development, you can cross debug from your host to your guest. One of the kind of nifty features, because you have a loader that runs the user space process as opposed to something running inside a guest, it can directly access any host resource, including directly on the host file system. So one trick I've used is you can build a kernel on the host itself, put it in an appropriate subdirectory. You can export the subdirectory to the OS loader when it loads, so I can load a kernel directly from the host file system, not from the guest disk image, load that into the memory before I boot, and the loader shows up as a device called host zero. I can boot that kernel, then I can run GDB on my host against the thing I just compiled, and have sitting there with all the source and debug symbols on my host, and then debug my kernel on the guest. The other thing I found it very useful for is testing MFCs. So I have a desktop at home that runs 10, and I have a guest for 8, 9, and 10. A little NFS mount that's free that I use to do merges for their user source. And so when I want to test my merge, I do the merge, I boot up my guest, I do a build over everything inside the guest, test it, and then I'm fine to commit.
You're clearly not MFC drivers.
Well, no, this is not for drivers. Okay. The other thing, it does support, because NetApp needs it as a feature, so that's not had to use yet. You can pass through PCI devices from the host to the guest, which would be useful for doing device driver development.
Sure.
Okay. You have a question?
Yeah. Relative stability of both FreeBSD and other operating systems. so far, how many people with this? Like, if, you know, if you're taking and wanting to deploy this thing as a great tool for setting up a cluster of development servers that are all running on Linux, that kind of thing.
Kind of question or answer
to this? Kind of how practical is that kind of, how stable is it?
I think the goal is to get there.
Not going to hold you to it.
Well, but I can't speak on behalf of what the folks who are being paid money to do that they're doing. I know they have clients who are using Linux in production, Linux as guests in some kind of production environment. So there are certainly folks who are motivated to use this as a production class hypervisor. I think it still has some growing pains to get through, but it works fine for me in practice. I even fix the one thing so that I can suspend and resume my laptop with a guest active, and the guest still works when I have to resume. Well, things like that. So, like, that doesn't fit. You know, if you do that with VirtualBox or something else that doesn't have the right kernel thing, that will, then you suspend and resume. It doesn't do the right thing to kind of just re-enable VNX mode on the host CPU, and it'll crash. So, I think Beehive is the only hypervisor that'll do that correctly with 3DST, for example.
Speaking on that point, VirtualBox and VMware, they require, or not necessarily required, but they recommend that you use their kernel models for various aspects of timekeeping and network interfaces and stuff like that. Outside of the Vert.io aspect of Beehive, is there any other sort of stuff like that floating around that is an optional thing that you could use?
Well, they're not. At the moment, they're things that are not really optional. It's just when something is critical, it just gets, you know, shoehorned out of VisaLand and actually into the kernel. So, for example, the timer is used to actually live in the VisaLand process. But you can imagine that you can get some pretty odd latency patterns if you're waiting for a user process to get scheduled time to actually trigger a virtual interrupt. So the timers now all live inside the kernel module itself. The same with the interrupt controllers, but they also used to be in userland. But that thing is enough latency sensitive, you don't want to have to bounce all the way out to userland to decide to trigger an interrupt, especially if you have to do 3 or 4 octals to kind of get everything correct. Another reason that's kind of tricky is the interrupt hardware is rather incestuous. So, like, your emulated PICs need to really kind of be able to talk directly to the emulated local APIC for each CPU, especially if you want to handle all the legacy crap dealing with 8259As and how they raise this kind of virtual pin to say they're busy, and when they raise it, you have to ask them what they want, and you have to do it in a non-racing manner, so it's basically required putting that into the kernel. But, so, there's not, in Beehive so far, it's not been a case where things are obviously one place or the other. It's they're in Newfoundland, except if we're really important, then we move it. George?
No, I was going to ask, how old is Beehive track system time? Because that's probably the one with all the ends.
I don't know. My purpose is it hasn't mattered yet.
Yeah.
I do know that they recently, Vert.io has a, it is a standard. They even had, I can't remember which working group, I think it's Oasis, they had a working group. They're trying to approve 1.0 of their standard. In addition to network and block, now they have a standard for a RNG, for feeding your friend your pseudo-random number generator inside your guest. And Beehive does support that interface to allow the host to provide entropy to the guest itself. But I don't know how accurate. I do know that they have done some work to try to make the timer interrupts themselves be fairly accurate in terms of when the host, the guest, would get interrupted or really wants to even interrupt. I don't know if how well wall time actually tracks inside the guest.
It's something to look at. It's almost always a problem.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine why. VMware has certain hacks for certain special CPU ID settings. You can find out what it means for a virtual CSC kind of runs at, for example, and things so that guests can kind of try to be smarter about it. But VS currently does not have anything like that in place. Any other questions?
No.
ARM?
So I think it's a matter of if you have an architecture that has hardware support for it, for example, PowerPC with a hardware with accelerated hardware acceleration hypervisors, that's not outside of the discussion. Currently, it's very x86 focused, and there are some levels of abstraction, but there's also a lot of it's pretty x86 specific, and that will need to be rethought more when it comes time to do that. But it is kind of in the default process. It's not entirely designed out to do that eventually. Certainly, you can imagine on whatever AMD's 64-bit ARM thing that might be quite compelling. Yes?
On the resource side of things, as far as allocating memory and which CPU,
Is the configuration there where we're actually saying yes to certain or multiple CPUs?
You can.
So that is something you can choose to do. Originally, this was part of Beehive being hackish. Originally, when you wanted to run a guest, you actually had to explicitly exclude a region of RAM from the host OS that was sitting there so the guest could have this entire memory. One of the things that the folks worked quite hard on, and it looks like a simple feature, but it actually required quite a lot of work. But now, if Beehive properly does the right thing abstraction-wise, so that to the kernel, the guest physical IO space is like another VM space inside the process, which means, in theory, you can end up anything in and out of the guest physical IO space. Part of doing this, though, then means that the memory that backs a VM is now anonymous, meaning that if it needs to swap, or if it needs to, or if you need to do overcommit or things like that, that all works pretty transparently. So you can start up your guest with however much memory you want. It's a matter of, do you put switch refresh from the host? And you debug that like any other giant, large, RAM sucking, you know, application around your host. In terms of CPUs, by default, I think they float, but you do have the option, if you wish, to pin them to a set of CPUs. And again, as an administrator, if you want to do that, you probably also need to take them out of the default set and you need to manage that. So the tools are available to do that for you, but it does require you to be intentional on how you want to arrange it.
How well restricted are the guests to amount of memory that you allocate to it? Is it like a hard cap or?
Well, you give it a size of RAM that it should have, like 4 megs or whatever. And effectively, their entire address space is bounded by that. So they have one anonymous VM object that is 64 megs in size based on when you actually fault pages, when you actually get RAM assigned to it. Similar to if you called malloc 64 meg in an EVLAN process. It's effectively the same thing as that.
Yeah.
So whatever the equivalent to that, I guess.
Yeah.
John, are there any caps in doing silly things like you want to see what 64 processors looks like even though your box only has 4?
Well, if it's just a multi-threaded process, if you don't pin them, it'll do that. It'll probably run like a dog. Part of Unix's task is, you know, pull its foot. You know, how does it get there? So.
True, but I mean, there are some people who say, like, well, I want to see what happens. You know, does this process work at all in some strange setup? You know,
I don't know. Why don't you try it and tell us?
Oh, okay, thank you.
I would not be so foolhardy. You have to make sure your guests can handle that many.
That's true.
As far as the overkill of memory, are there any there are any plans to write some stuff for the AP kernel itself such that if the working set has grown and it increases, it can yield some of those pages from the VM object back to the host so that it's not kind of greedy?
Well, part of the problem is that you would have to, the guest would have to have a way of telling you which pages it didn't
run
anymore.
You would have to change the previous channel or some kind of back channel over the
Well, or any guest, you would have to have some kind of interface for whatever the guest is. And I don't know if there's already a standard to do that.
I don't think there is a
set. But I mean,
heard of anything like that.
That would be pretty simple to implement in terms of the like the hypervisor side. I think the harder part would be the interface and then how many guests can you get to support that sort of thing.
I'm thinking like trim on solid state.
Right. Yeah. The problem is it's RAM, not disk.
Yeah.
There's no reason you couldn't do that, especially it would become almost equivalent to like an mInvite, mInvite don't need, except not quite because it's not your normal address space. It's this alternate one that you kind of have directly in this, but it's doable.
Right.
Any other questions? Yep.
Yeah, so you said memory location based on the user space, right?
Well, no. It's kind of
hard. Because I was wondering what happens when I try to allocate 2 meg or 168, and you don't have that particular strip.
Well, so it's just an anonymous VM object. It's equivalent to calling mmap of Navanon for like 64 megs or whatever, 512 meg or whatever you want to have. Then it's up to how the kernel normally handles an address space with a big object in it as to how it will do that. So the fact that previously already does transparent super pages means that in the host it will use super pages, for example, it needs to. I don't know if we'll also use super pages in nested page tables. I think it might. I think it might be harder for that often to transparently show up. You have to kind of have all your stars aligned so that on the host you can get those to align and the kernel will do that. I don't know if the guest physical address will be aligned such that the and the guest collection will also be able to be supervised with mine. Probably like some direct mapping things as well. So that is actually that shouldn't be too hard to have that aligned for certain cases. It's kind of just a fallout of the normal fact that the VM already does that. And to the VM system, because they've made it just be alternate address space and it's not a big special case anymore, it's just like any other big chunk of anonymous memory. So it'll do reservations and break them up into that mutable and things like that. That's it. All right.
Yeah.